I'd like to share with you something that I came across in going through my papers on my desk and in my study. It was a note I sent to my mom via email. And I said, here's the definition of gravitation, the law of gravity. The universal force of attraction that affects all matter. And that definition is taken from the New Encyclopedia Britannica, Volume 5, page 435. So then I wrote, my definition of love, the divine universal power to attract that affects all living things. What do you think? Am I off track?
So you no.
It's interesting that you parallel it with attracting all matter.
Yeah, love is kind of the spiritual equivalent of gravity. I like it.
Good. I feel good. Yes, I do. I'm not a scientist at really. I have, that's one of my weak points. I could have become one. It isn't that I didn't have the ability to, I just didn't have the attraction. I guess I didn't
Didn't
have
have enough
the,
love. No,
I didn't have the
no science gravity.
gravity. Well, I wasn't attracted to biology because of the nomenclature. I just did not like nomenclature. And I wasn't attracted to chemistry because of the chemicals involved in my allergies. And so I wasn't attracted to that. And then physics, I was attracted to physics. But without taking chemistry, how can you go on and take physics? So that's kind of where I sat. And I've always mused that God carefully steered me away from things that he didn't want me getting into. Science seemed to be one of them.
Was kind of laughing. You say it stayed away from biology because of the nomenclature, and yet you went into theology, which is probably no
I
more
beg your pardon.
nomenclature than biology does.
I stayed away from systematic theology. I'm in biblical studies. I'm in Old Testament. And that doesn't have a lot of nomenclature. It has languages you have to learn, but there's not a lot of nomenclature. Theology, yeah. I was never attracted to theology.
So nomenclature is nonsensical terms that are made up and bandied about in a theoretical universe.
Oh, I don't know. I just didn't like having to learn terms that to me did not have the meaning they were supposed to fit.
Well, that's pretty much what
Well,
religion is, all kinds of words that no
that
longer mean what they originally did.
No.
Well, I was going to say that any field, you're an expert at the point in which you understand what all those terms are referring to. And that that nomenclature is just shorthand for a big involved study that you don't want to have to repeat. You don't want to have to repeat the derivation of the law of gravity every time you talk about it. So we just say that, well, we're talking about gravity here. So I would suggest that nomenclature encompasses pretty much any field of detailed study, because the nomenclature is just shorthand for all
I
that work.
guess for me, biblical studies nomenclature feels more natural.
And that's probably the key, is that the it was a language you already understood.
And then the other reason I wasn't attracted to science is because in fifth and sixth grade, my textbook couldn't answer the questions I had about it. I got very disillusioned.
Should have been an you should have been in an advanced course and weren't.
And you see, that's the thing I think God didn't want. Because I would have been, okay, this is where I'm going. I've always felt that way.
I think I've talked it here before about discovering the wonder of God's, why God hasn't chosen to heal me of some character flaws. And the answer comes back that, well, if God did that, I suppose that I would have a lot of spiritual arrogance. And then I add to that, it's bad enough as it is,
Well, shall we move on to Revelation 5?
As I recall, I think we were going to start on verse 9 or 8, although we did talk about 8. So,
I want to backtrack just first. I have something to kind of mildly correct that I said last week because I did a little more study. And that has to do with Revelation 6. And it's the first one. It's the white horse. I compared the white horse with the white horse in Revelation 19. And I have come to the conclusion that the first part of the white horse could be the early Christian church. But then that white horse was given, the rider was given a bow and was given a crown. And he went forth to conquer.
Yeah, there's some clues there that I think are a tip-off.
Yeah.
For one thing, the fact that it's given to him in 19, he already has it. It's just inherent.
Right.
And then a bow is an aggressive weapon.
Yes, it is. And the rider on in 19, the rider on the horse, he's called faithful and true, and he judges and makes war justly. So a just war, not evil war. And he has a name written on him that no one knows and so on. He wore a robe dyed with blood, meaning he shed his own blood. This is not war, blood he got from killing people. And then heaven's armies wearing fine linen and so on. And then from his mouth comes a sharp sword. This is the only weapon in the chapter, and that is the word of God, is not sword. So I still think Constantine is there, but I think there's a shift within it, very possibly. I just wanted to make that note. So you said we were going to start with verse 9. Okay. Who would be willing to read?
Do that if you want the Good News Bible. Otherwise, I'll have to bring up Jonathan Gallagher's.
I don't mind the Good News Bible or Jonathan either.
Okay, so where are we again?
Verse 9.
And so read to verse
of chapter,
verse 11.
Five, 9 through 11.
Oh, wait a minute. I was in the wrong chapter. Chapter five. I feel like saying read to the end of the chapter.
Yeah, it's all one unit.
Okay. 5:9 to the end. Okay. They sang a new song. You are worthy to take the scroll and break open its seals. For you were killed, and by your sacrificial death, you were brought for God. People from every tribe, language, nation, and race. You have made them a kingdom of priests to serve our God, and they shall rule on earth. Again, I looked, and I heard angels, thousands and millions of them. They stood around the throne, the four living creatures and the elders, and they sang in a loud voice. The Lamb who was killed is worthy to receive power, wealth, wisdom, and strength, honor, glory, and praise. I heard every creature in heaven, on earth, in the world below, and in the sea, all living beings in the universe, and they were singing, To him who sits on the throne and to the Lamb, be praise and honor, glory and might forever and ever. And the four living creatures answered, Amen. And the elders fell down and worshiped.
Oh, questions?
Well, I think I already brought this up at some point, but now that we're actually at the verse, I guess I could review it again. When I went through this, I was troubled. So I always start digging really deep when something doesn't feel like it matches correctly about this purchasing, redeeming purchase for God. I'm like, I don't believe God's operating in the commerce system. However, he will use the language at times. Mm-hmm. You know,
so what's the original purchase?
And who's getting paid? You know, right. I mean, I went to one of the top theologians at the seminary one day, and it was a guy that I really trusted. And I really wanted to know the answer. And so I said, if Jesus paid the price for our sins with his blood, who got paid? And he did not have a good answer. And what that told me was, even the theologians don't know. I guess I'm going to have to get God to explain this to me, which took another 10 years. But it does make more sense now. So when I read this, I said, okay, I'm going to use all the equipment that I have available to me. And so I looked up the words in the Greek, and I looked up the root words behind the words, which sometimes is very helpful. And then just pieced the potential thoughts together that could have come out of the definitions instead of just letting the slant or the opinions of the translators and their bias. You know, I could go a little deeper and get behind to see where they got it from. And one thing that jumped out at me, and as I thought about it and I'm praying for insight, one of the things that this word is talking about means to go to the town square or the marketplace. And I thought about that in the context of this verse, in the context of, you know, God sending his son to this world. Well, this world was the headquarters of commerce. You know, Satan invented that. And so this was where all the trafficking was going on, was right here, which is the town square. So God sends his son to the town square where all the activity is going on, where all the cheating is going on, where there's likely violence and robbery and, you know, everything that goes along with this. And he exposes himself. He makes himself vulnerable by going there to win our trust, because that's the whole issue.
Yeah.
And in fact, it said in the definition that the idea of purchase or redeemed is by implication.
Mm-hmm.
Like, oh, that's interesting. So that's not even the main meaning of the word.
Right. It's implied.
It's implied. So you don't have to. You know, it doesn't have to mean something if it's only implied. And it also includes the concepts of arousing, to wake up, to lift up from inactivity or obscurity, to lift up even from disease or death. Those are all in this word. So what Jesus comes is to arouse from within us, to raise us up from our diseased mental illness by demonstrating nothing but love and grace and truth.
And if you want to mention the blood is the truth, because it was by his blood that he demonstrated the truth,
yes,
that he's not the destroyer.
Yes.
I come at it from a little different direction and think I get to the same place, but for what it's worth, it's, to me, this is an exchange. Purchasing in the ancient world was an exchange. And it's the same principle as substitution. Mm-hmm. So who made the first substitution? Well, we did. We exchanged the truth for a lie.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And so Jesus, by shedding his blood, got us back.
Exchanges the lie for the truth.
Exchanging the lie for the truth.
Yeah.
Mm. I always tend to take shortcuts instead of longer ones, but I have, for the blood, I have both a shortcut and a long cut, I guess.
A detour.
A detour. Yeah. To me, as you were talking, Floyd, the image that came to my mind was the clown going around and undoing what Magus was doing.
I letting went off people, and watched that this weekend. That free. Was very good.
Setting people free, you know. And the ultimate one was the poor people who were being controlled by him directly as puppets. And Jesus undoing that and getting in the harness. Mm. And Magus couldn't control him.
Mm.
That to me works as substitution. It works to me as exchange. It works to me, for me, as everything that we tend to metaphorize with sometimes vague language.
Mm-hmm.
I also just noticed, looking at my notes here, that this is connected to 1 Peter 2:9. Yeah. A people for God's own possession.
Mm-hmm.
And I was going through my, speaking of organizing files, for the last 3 days, I have been intensely going through many, many files because I'm uploading all of my Revelation recordings to the internet so people could listen to them, and all the files and all the extra materials I've added. And I came across an article that I had written about that verse. And I think I wrote it for this verse in my research because I have it in my notes. And it comes from the Greek word, I don't know how you pronounce it, but arete, A-R-E-T-E. And I must have written a whole article on that word, and it was very fascinating and very inspiring, because it refers to an attitude that the Greeks coveted. It was their heroes who had this attitude, this mindset, and that was a boldness that would defeat, that would stand up to absolutely anything. You know, they were willing to die to be known for having that kind of an attitude. And they said that the greatest demonstration of this attitude or this disposition of arete, of boldness in the face of danger, was Alexander the Great. And they went on to explain that the reason that he was conquering the world so fast and overcoming overwhelming odds was because he had this spirit. But it wasn't just that he had this spirit, it was the way he treated all the people in his army. It was the way he related to them. He respected them. He honored them. He inspired them. And that gave them that spirit and that unity, and their enemies, their kings, you know, were rulers and dictators, and their army, you know, didn't have a lot of loyalty or anything. And so they were very easy to overcome. Whereas he, all his men were fiercely loyal to him, and nobody could stop him. But
and
they were
using. If you don't mind my adding one little line.
Yeah.
When he came to Babylonia, the Babylonians accepted him with open arms without a conquest.
Maybe because he had that spirit and they recognized him. They also knew they couldn't win.
Right. Well, they were already under Persian rule.
Yes.
So they were willing to trade Alexander for the Persians.
And as I thought about that, you know, in this context, right here in this verse, Jesus is the ultimate demonstration of that spirit without the violence factor.
Mm-hmm.
So he has this boldness that will go all the way to death fearlessly and yet love his enemies all the way to death, mm-hmm. which was very, mm-hmm. I mean, it was exponentially beyond what Alexander the Great had.
Mm-hmm.
And this is what, when we actually begin to see that this is what motivated him, that spirit is what motivated Alexander's army to follow him. And so in Revelation, you have, like in chapter 19, all the armies of heaven follow him. They're not following him because they have to. They're attracted to him like gravity.
Yeah.
You know, they, okay, that's the spirit. That's what we were created for. This is worth dying for. Let's go.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how he purchases. He wins.
That's exactly their trust.
It's mm-hmm. not a mm-hmm. payoff. It's not a bribe. It's earning their respect and their loyalty and their passion.
He's gotten us away from the one who coerced us.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Which is where I was going to ask a question or kind of put something else, because as I was reading this and thinking about the ransom part, as when we started talking about it, the thing that popped into my head was Hosea ransoming his wife back.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So he actually had to pay something, and he had to pay it to somebody, but it was in order to restore her to the place where she could trust him again.
Mm-hmm.
And freedom.
Mm-hmm.
Which meant she was still free to leave him if she wanted.
Mm-hmm. And in a way, he didn't pay it to Satan. He paid it to us.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. I mean, in a sense, in the Hosea example, he shouldn't have had to pay anything for her. She was his wife. In their culture, that meant he owned her already.
Mm-hmm.
But so why would he pay? Well, because I don't think she would have understood that she was free if that payment had not been taken care of. And I think that's directly applicable to the use of the cross as a payment, because many of us won't believe that we're free unless we think that price has been taken care of.
Mm-hmm. Mm.
And I think, as much as I hate it, I think it really, at least initially, does not make any difference who you think got paid. If you think God had to be paid, then believe it. You'll get over it if you keep following the trail. If you think the devil had to get paid, believe it. Because the real problem is us.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Just like you pointed out, Mark, if we don't think the debt's been paid, then we don't believe we're free. It doesn't matter who it got paid to.
Right.
It's whoever we think it needs to be paid to. That's what has to be unlocked in our minds. That reminds me of what happened to me when I left Texas. We were living there for, I don't know, about 5 years. And the last place we lived was this trailer house, and it was a miracle because I was going down the tubes really fast financially. And providentially, we came across this trailer out in the boonies in this place. And the guy who owned it, I mean, I talked to the neighbors, and they put me on the phone with him. And he only came there like once or twice a year as a just to go fishing or something. And so he let me rent it for $50 a month.
Mm.
And he kept all the utilities in his name, even the phone. And so he would hand write a bill for me each month and I would send him money. Well, I started getting behind. And I felt terrible about it, but I just couldn't make enough money. And I got further and further and further and further behind. I was thousands of dollars behind. He never once asked me for money. In fact, I asked him if I could build a roof over the trailer because the roof of the trailer was starting to rot through. And he's like, sure, can I send you some money for material? And I'm like, no. I owe you all this money. You know, I can't ask for you to give me money. And so as I could scrape it up, I would get money for materials, and I built a freestanding roof over it, which kept the sun off, and it helped a lot. But then it became clear that we were supposed to move to Michigan. You know, it was a God thing, very clearly a God thing. And yet I said, I will not leave and leave this guy holding the bag with his money. I'm just not going to do it. I can't live with my conscience. You know, I don't care if God wants me to go or not. This has to be paid before I leave. And so that reminds me of this, because it didn't matter who the money went to, but I knew this money was owed. And I knew that this guy had been so gracious, and he probably wouldn't have said anything, but that just made it harder. You know, it's like, no, I will not leave him holding the bag as nice as he's been to us. And so I was talking to my dad, and I told him this. And dad said, give me his phone number. And I'm going, oh, man, I know my dad too well. You know, he'll throw him down or something. I was really afraid of it. But I didn't have a lot of choice. And so he called back a little later. He said, it's all taken care of. But he wouldn't tell me what he did, of course. And so that nagged at me for years. I wondered if the guy actually got paid everything, or if he struck a deal with him, or what. Well, after my dad died, a number of years after, we lived in the house, I was going through papers, and I found a copy of those papers, the handwritten bills that he would send me every month. And he had sent a whole copy to my dad. And I found a record where my dad had actually taken out a loan and paid the guy in full. And, and that brought resolution to that nagging, wondering if the guy ever got paid. So in this sense, you know, he comes to our world and he looks at all the debts that we're fighting over with each other, debt collecting and everything, said, give them all to me.
Mm-hmm.
Come on, bring all the debts, lay all of our sins on him, all of our debts, and he pays for our debts. If whoever is debt collecting, they're paid in full through Jesus. That's what makes sense to me.
Mm-hmm.
That includes the debts I think I'm collecting on somebody emotionally. I'm like, well, God, I want you to punish them. He said, by the way, I paid that debt too. If you want to collect on it, you talk to me. I'm like, oh, that's a little awkward.
I would like to point out something, that if you have to buy people, they're slaves.
Mm-hmm.
That's the condition.
In this context, part of the problem is that they believe they're slaves.
We can be slaves to lies we don't even know we have.
The rest of that verse, I think, gives a strong clue as to why we had to be bought. The slavery we were bought from. Because those words, tribe, language, people, and nation are all divisive words. They are words that we use to segregate people.
Mm-hmm.
And according to Jesus in John 17, and according to Paul in 1 Corinthians or 2 Corinthians 10, I think, or wherever, I got to memorize it one of these days, 12, where all things are summed up in Christ, it says he abolishes all power, all authority, everything. All these symbols of hierarchy and all these divisive labels have to be paid off and eliminated entirely. And that's what he's paying for. He's paying for the abolition of all of our separating criteria, all of our prejudices, everything that makes us not feel like siblings.
I was going to say earlier that one would want to be careful how one said this, but because of the fact that we have to believe it before it makes, before it's effective, is that a lot of God's dealing with us and setting us straight has to do with, it's the word I was afraid to use is placebo. It's a placebo effect. It works because you believe it. And even with non-placebo, you know, science-based medicine, if you don't believe it, there's a fair chance it's not going to do much.
Right.
I'm thinking in particular of plastic surgeons. Somebody has a defect on their face, or they just don't like their face. They will correct it, and the person will look in the mirror and say, "No, I look the same." So it's to me, it's weird, but absolutely true. You know, you didn't do anything. My nose is still crooked, even though it's been straightened out. And so I think that God's dealing with that with us in respect to the atonement, in that unless we believe set us free, it's not going to do any good. And that's why I kind of said, well, the problem is that they believe they're slaves. If you believe you're a slave, even if you're set free, you're still going to act like a slave.
Mm-hmm. I think that's right. Israel's problem in the wilderness.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
They couldn't get rid of their slave status.
Mm-hmm.
That's what happened before the Civil War.
They were slaves.
Mm-hmm.
They were, when they were declared free, many of them, tens of thousands of them, didn't leave. They didn't change. They either had never heard about it, or they simply thought it was a trick.
Mm.
And they didn't believe it. And so they continued to be slaves.
What I heard is that a lot of them chose to be slaves because it was easier than trying to figure out how to live.
That's true too.
Mm-hmm.
That's true too.
You have a lot of them were born under it. They had never known anything else, and suddenly you say you're free without any idea of what that means.
It's like
no wonder they had problems.
It's like taking an animal in a cage. It's never known freedom. And letting them out, they're likely to come back to it.
Mm-hmm.
What was that '60s that Born Free? How they took this captive lion, tried to set her free in the wild. Very difficult to do.
Yeah, I want to mention comment on verse 10. You made them a kingdom and priests to our God, and they will rule on earth. That's a take from Exodus 19, and this purchase is kind of embedded there. So if you go to Exodus 19.
Exodus 19 is a marriage proposal that was.
That's how I see it too.
That was turned down. He got stood up.
Exodus 19, verse 6. Actually, verse 4. You saw what I did to the Egyptians and how I lifted you up on eagle's wings. which is a feminine image, I believe, upon eagle's wings and brought you to me. So now if you faithfully obey me and stay true to my covenant, you will be my most precious possession out of all people, since the whole earth belongs to me. You will be a kingdom of priests for me and a holy nation. That word precious possession is, I believe, a romantic term.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's explicitly a marriage proposal. And when their answer in verse 8 was, everything, everything you said we will do is not the answer he wanted.
No. No, because they're trying to make the marriage proposal work.
You know, they're saying, oh, we got a new slave master. Yes, master, we'll do whatever you say, master.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. He's like, oh, no, mm-hmm. not what I had in mind.
And that's why the prophets make it very clear that the reason God hated Asherah as Yahweh's wife, and we actually have an inscription that they found archaeology in Israel where someone had written Asherah, Yahweh's wife. And the reason God hated that is because Israel was denying its own status with Yahweh.
Mm.
Mm. Israel was to be Yahweh's wife, not Asherah.
Oh, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, I think it's also significant here where it says a kingdom of kings and priests to our God.
Not for our God.
In other words, we become the highest administrators of the kingdom of heaven for the whole universe.
Well, and it says they will rule on earth.
They will rule on earth, but I think they're going to rule the entire universe from earth.
And say more about the difference. Say more about the difference between two versus from four.
Yeah,
I think it resonates.
I don't quite understand that.
Yes, what it resonates with me is the many references that I keep coming across, where it talks about our God and His Christ. Once I started seeing the implications of that, that Christ is not talking about our Christ, the Messiah. It's talking about God's Christ, the Messiah for God. Because God's the one on trial. The Lamb came and took responsibility for the case by taking the scroll out of his hand. The Lamb is God's Christ, the one who is assigned the role of salvaging God's reputation entirely. And the way he does that is by revealing the truth about God, exposing it, breaking open the seals so it can be very plain to everyone. God needs a Christ, and we need a Christ, and it's the same one, but it's two different roles. And so here, this Christ, who just took the scroll to become God's Christ, is now comes to this world and solicits all these people who are willing to follow him and help him be God's Christ as kings and priests. So the focus is ministering to God instead of ministering to others on behalf of God. Now, it may involve both, but that's why I think it says here, we are kings and priests to our God. Just like Jesus is a Christ for our God or to our God. That, I've never heard anybody really talk about that. And yet, the more I look at it, the more solid it is, all through Scripture even.
It's more like which direction they're facing.
Yes, yes, yes.
If it's forward, then it's kind of facing outward.
On behalf of.
If it's
of,
two, yes. then it's yes. facing inward.
Ministering to on behalf of someone else.
I think the word for could designate also that if you're doing it for someone.
That's true.
You're in their debt. You are there still, they're kind of their slave. And you are still, they are the person that you're a slave of.
So then it would just depend on which system your mentality is operating at, what operating system you're using as to how you
exactly
how you interpret the phrases.
Yeah. It's a let's see. And you made them to God. I'm trying to figure this out. I know the words, but they don't make sense. You purchased to God. Let's see. You made them a kingdom and priests. Okay. You made them to God. Oh, to our God. Sorry. John writes Greek a little bit like Hebrew. To our God, a kingdom and priests. That's actually literally what it says. Kingdom of priests. When everybody's a king and everybody's a priest, there is no king.
Mm-mm.
There is no priest.
Mm-mm.
That is, there's no one on top.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, yeah.
It just registered to me that the people or the creatures or whatever that are saying or singing this is the 24 elders and the four creatures.
Mm-hmm.
They're the first ones on record as singing the new song.
Mm-hmm.
Now later, the 144,000 are singing the new song. But it's interesting that here, if the 24 elders and the four creatures are saying that he has made us kings and priests to our God, and they will reign on earth, wow, that's a context we don't usually put together, is it?
And then if we move on, it says, I looked and I heard the sound of many angels surrounding the throne, the living creatures and the elders. They numbered in the millions and thousands of thousands. They said in a loud voice, worthy is the slaughtered lamb to receive power, wealth, wisdom, and might, honor and glory and blessing. And it seems to me that that is a real acceptance of the nature of God's kingdom. The kind of kingdom it is, the kind of ruling that's going to take place.
You know, if this is a synopsis of the Great Controversy, and I think it is, this chapter, then I believe this verse where it says the angels join with a new song happened at the Ascension. And like the quote you had where, you know, at the cross, they suddenly going, oh, this works. All the methods we've tried through 4,000 years have not been very successful. But this is working. Okay, we are 100% behind you, and we are 100% disconnecting all sympathies from the devil. We have been influenced by his subtle suggestions that sounded really promising. We've tried a whole bunch of them. None of them have been very successful at all. And what the Son is doing, now that works. We never thought of doing that. And so now he has the full unification of the angels to completely support what he's doing, instead of, well, we should try this, or maybe this will work, or maybe if we exterminate everybody and start over, that'll work, or thus all the confusion we have from the Old Testament.
You've encapsulated something that I have long thought. I don't teach it in the classroom. I think it's too advanced for my students to be able to handle. But I have long wondered if God didn't allow all the things to happen in the Old Testament. And he himself actually thunders from Sinai, spills out the law. This is what it lays down the law, you could say. And 40 days later, they're worshiping a golden calf.
Mm-hmm.
To demonstrate this Does this work? Does this work? Does this work? No, yes. It doesn't work. And so then finally you have the angel standing at the edge of heaven with thunderbolts in their hands, mm-hmm. exaggerating the description Ellen White gives in Desire of Ages.
Mm-hmm.
They have these thunderbolts and they're just waiting for God to come and right. destroy the earth. They're done. They've tried everything.
And they will turn around and they say, you are just and right in exterminating them.
And yes, they would have.
Yep.
And so,
but the seed would have still been
God. God suddenly disappears. The Son of God disappears. And a woman gets pregnant. And the angels watch for 9 months while they think about everything.
They're going, what is he up to?
And
about 6 centimeters.
At the end of the 9 months, this baby is born, and they realize this is what he has become.
Yes.
And they are in shock.
Yeah.
And then they are in awe.
Yes.
And then they are in love.
And then they're loyal.
Exactly.
But did it take the cross for them to fully understand?
To really fully understand the nature of Satan.
Yes.
He was a murderer.
It had to be that unmasked.
That all of his make-believed ways of doing good were wrong, wrong-headed.
Which
the economics, the kingship, the
artificial law.
Artificial law. Mm-hmm. All of that was wrong-headed. It didn't make people right.
But the fact that highly intelligent, unfallen angels who have existed for eons could be, it would take all the way to after the cross for them to be disabused speaks enormously about how compelling Satan's arguments were.
Mm-hmm.
They had to be so compellingly good that it mm-hmm. would take the death of the Son of God to finally break him open.
Mm-hmm.
It had to be.
Yeah. Well, and here they were, his friends. They had been.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
The reason they stayed loyal was because there was something in that attraction, mm-hmm. that love that kept them there.
Mm-hmm.
But they still saw it Satan's way in many ways. They still believed that.
Yes.
If you lay down the law, if you do this, if you do that, it will work.
Everything that we're still teaching today.
Yeah. And that's why what led Ellen White to write A Soul in Submission to the Will of Our Father will develop the character of a rebel.
Yeah. Mm. What is startling to me is that, you know, at Sinai, you have the might and power.
Mm-hmm.
That didn't work. And you have the still small voice, and that didn't work. Because there's still only a remnant that believed, that followed, that really saw that it's not about Jesus showing his might and power. It's about his love and all of his traits.
You know,
the power in weakness.
That's the problem. The weakness.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The vulnerable.
That's why so many refuse to follow.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Because we're addicted to power.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And we insist that if God doesn't use his power to punish and defend us and set things right, then he's not a God worth worshiping.
Yeah.
Which is the opposite of what this song is about.
That is.
They're saying you are worthy to worship because mm-hmm. you have demonstrated your love through weakness.
But take a look at his life. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, we define what we mean by God by power and its use.
Mm-hmm.
And so anything that doesn't use that power doesn't seem like God. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if you've kind of gone past this, but back on the angels and them not getting it until after the crucifixion. And particularly in what you were saying about Sinai there and the whole Old Testament, I think that in some respect, and I don't really have good text for this, but it makes sense to me that since God and his use of power are at question in the whole great controversy, that in some respects, God abdicated is not the right word, but kind of put the running of the universe into receivership to say, okay, you guys have questions about my power. What would you do? And that the angels said, well, you need to do this. Well, I can tell you it's not going to work, but we'll try it. And one after another, the false understanding of the onlooking universe, God dealt with. Now, I kind of have a little bit of a problem with, well, it was kind of rough on the Israelites, but, you know, there's a lot of that goes on. So I really think that maybe a lot of the Old Testament is God showing the onlooking universe, yeah, this isn't going to work.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that's what this assembly of the sons of God is. Because I think God actually really honestly runs a democracy. These are not rubber stamp officials.
You get that from Revelation, where you have the lamb with the beast that's a lamb with horns.
Oh, 13?
Yeah, 13.
The lamb-like beast?
The lamb-like beast with horns. He is a democracy, but unfortunately he has two horns.
Mm.
Republicans and Democrats.
And they both are more than willing to exercise force.
Oh, yes. And they duke it out between them. I think that's why Ellen White in The Great Controversy was so extolling of American democracy, is that it came the closest.
Yes.
It really is a consensual governance, not a democracy. And a consensual, and I get that from Jonathan Gallagher. A consensual governance in which everyone is a willing partner. They're not consenting to be governed by God. They're consenting to the kind of king, by the kind of governance he has. And that he carries his universe with him. He's always turning to them and asking them what they think.
And I believe in the Old Testament period, because God has allowed the leadership or even the participation of everyone, I don't know how that works, but there certainly is this representative body in heaven. I mean, it says that pretty clearly.
Now, the sons of God are the representatives of our planets.
And they don't just come and share gossip. I mean, they're coming to do business, which means if God respects them and if God respects freedom, like he says he does, those angels and those sons of God and whoever, they are free to offer their own ideas. And because they are a representative body, not just for where they come from, but the other direction, they represent God's government to the universe because it's a representative government. And so they have votes or however they do it. We have to, you know, filter it through our understanding. And they make determinations like, well, let's send a flood. You know, nothing else seems to have worked here. You sure you want to do that? Yeah. Well, they can use God's name because they're authorized by God. It's like having a signet ring. Ping, God said, send the flood. And so we read the Old Testament going, what do you mean? God said to do this, and God said to genocide this, and God did this, and God did. Well, yeah, his name's getting used all over the place. And it's, yes, it's coming from heaven. Even Elijah can bring down fire from heaven, incinerate people at will. Is that God doing that? Well, Jesus says, you don't know what spirit you're of. And we're going, what? Well, what's going on? Well, if it was authorized by an assigned group of representatives, and they have the signature of God to stamp on all their papers that goes out, he gets the blame. And it's confusion all the way up until Jesus shows up. And all of a sudden, he's challenging all this stuff in the Old Testament. Mm-hmm. And he's saying, well, not so quick here. God's not really like that, which gets him killed. Mm-hmm. But finally, at least the rest of the universe says, oh, all these ideas we had were seductive enticements of the enemy. We thought we could resort to a little bit of violence here or a little bit of law enforcement there. None of it works. We just need to get hands off entirely and let Jesus come back here and let his idea. You know, Jesus, you tell us what's best, and we're all behind you now because we'd like to get this war over. Now they are entirely unified, not because they have to, not because it's a rubber stamp, but because they are fully convinced that his way is the only way that's going to work. Let's get the job done. Therefore, this riches and glory that is at our disposal, to supply all of our needs, that riches and glory, I think, includes all the assets of the entire universe who are all ready to do whatever it takes to come to our assistance so we can clarify this, bring it to a head, bring closure to it, and let evil be done away with so we can get back to living in love again in the whole universe. That's what I see this whole chapter celebrating.
This would, two things, one an explanation, but also a problem. This would explain to me a lot of places in the Old Testament. We were talking about Job this last night in the book group. And I was saying that God's answer to Job sounds more like the adversary to me. And, you know, if we have the onlooking universe saying, okay, here's what we need to do, and God says, well, try it. It might explain a lot of places in the Old Testament in particular. It was like, well, that just doesn't sound like what God would do. Abraham's another one. Mm-hmm. The problem, though, is that if I go there, how do I still make this, the Bible being about a revelation about God?
Mm-hmm.
If it's not really God doing this, how do I read this as telling me that this is what God is like?
Hebrews 1:1-3, I think the shorthand to explain that. God was communicating in various ways at various times to various people, but it was getting muddled.
I think the principle that God would use would be to meet people where they are and speak a language they can understand.
Yes.
But the way I've chosen to solve this problem is to suggest that there are two voices in the Old Testament. There's the voice of God's preferred will that usually comes first in a narrative sequence. And then there's the voice of God's adapted will that follows the people's response to God's preferred will, which is rejection.
Mm-hmm.
And they go their own route. And then God says, okay, and he ends up adapting to their will.
And would that same principle apply to the angels?
It could. The thing is that that's not something spelled out to us.
No, it's not. No.
So I can't use it that way.
Sure, I understand. But I'm saying that if there's a principle, it works. It usually works everywhere you apply it.
The thing that helps me doing that is I've gone through the narratives of the Old Testament. This only works in the narratives. I have not tried to apply it to poetry. It's almost invariable that almost every major problem, the conquest, the covenants, or circumcision, and on and on. There's this narrative sequence where God first makes his will known. It's ideal will. So he tells them he's gonna disperse the Canaanites, he's gonna displace them.
Mm-hmm.
And the Israelites will take over their homes. There's nothing about killing in Exodus.
And you will not have to fight.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's no killing in Exodus 23. And then you have the Amalekites come up, and Moses doesn't even consult God. He just says, well, fight. But then all of a sudden he needs God's power because they're losing. So he reaches his hands to heaven and plea, and he has to keep his hands up the whole time.
Yeah.
Which it should have been a lesson to him to consult God before trying to fight his own battle. And so I've seen this pattern over and over and over again with almost every problem I've faced.
Yeah.
And Sinai, the thundering from Sinai, is this response, God's response to the people. Mm-hmm. All the Lord has said we will do.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. So if they view him, if they are only willing to view him as a slave master.
Exactly.
Then that's the only voice they will recognize. And so he has to thunder.
Mm-hmm.
Because those first few verses in chapter 19 was the exact opposite of that.
What's interesting is in Deuteronomy, at the closing of the book, God is pictured as sitting down on the mountain and teaching people his law, like Jesus sat on the mountain and dealt the Beatitudes. Mm-hmm. It's an amazing picture. It's not what happened, but it's what God wanted to happen, I think.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I was just reading a couple of days ago about God telling Moses to bring up the 70 and various ones. And he said, I want you to come up and have a meal with me, but you know, the people are not to come up. The 70 can come up, but they need to keep their distance. Only you can come close. And what that tells me is that was not an arbitrary act on the part of God. It was God saying, the people are so afraid of me that if they even touch the mountain, they're going to die. The 70 have a more mature view, but they still are suspicious of me. If they get any closer than that distance, they're going to die from overload. Moses is the only one who actually believes the goodness of God enough to get close.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a cause-effect thing, not an arbitrary segregation on the part of God. Years ago, I heard a sermon by Dick Davidson, and really shocked me. But he explained in Exodus 19 where it's actually very oblique in most of our translations. In the Hebrew, it's quite clear. But he says, even in some translations, you'll see a word in italics that gives you a clue of what's going on here. When God first invited them, when he first talked about coming up on the mountain, he actually invited all of them to come up on the mountain.
Mm.
All of them.
Wow.
That was his initial invitation.
His preferred.
Well, as soon as
they reacted with any amount of fear, that's when he immediately turned around and says, don't touch it. Don't even get close.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Well, the translators, that's confusing. So they just said he told them twice not to come up. Actually, the first time he invited them up, but depending on their reaction, he has to adapt to that.
Yeah. Mm. I have a quotation I read. I finally finished reading Last Day Events, but this one, she says, for what was the great controversy permitted to continue throughout the ages? Why was it that Satan's existence was not cut short at the outset of his rebellion? It was that the universe might be convinced of God's justice and his dealing with evil. The sin might be received eternal condemnation by whom? Well, she goes on, in the plan of redemption, there are heights and depths that eternity itself can never exhaust. Marvels into which the angels desire to look. The redeemed only of all created beings have in their own experience known the actual conflict with sin. They have wrought with Christ, and even as angels could not do, they have entered the fellowship of his sufferings. Will they have no testimony as to the science of redemption, nothing that will be of worth to unfallen beings? And that's a question.
So see, you're going to have to study science anyway. You can't get out of it.
Oh, I don't mind studying the science of redemption. I love it when I find in science or in nature something that tells me about God.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm delighted that you think that love is like the law of gravity.
Mm.
I believe all science, that where you look at natural principles in operation, all those principles are given for us to discover, and they are tangible revelations of spiritual realities.
Well, the spiritual laws are like natural laws. In fact,
yes,
I have come to believe that you have human-made laws, you have which are artificial and contrived,
right?
And you have the Ten Commandments, which are moral law. They're not legal. They are moral.
Mm-hmm.
Principles, really.
Mm-hmm.
Yes. And then you have the laws of nature. I believe that moral law is more natural than natural law.
Yes.
Because God has to keep the balance of nature intact for natural law to work. He is the source of it. But in a sense, that is the way it works in moral law.
That's true.
Because he is the great attraction. He is the great lover. Mm-hmm. And all of our love for God comes out of his love for us.
Mm-hmm.
So we love because he first loved us. So it works the same way.
Mm-hmm.
I just think it's more intrinsic and more connected even than natural law.
In Romans 1, Paul says the hidden attributes of God are clearly revealed in the things that are created.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I think he's talking about. All the principles that you see in creation, you say, okay, what does this tell me about God? What does mm-hmm. this tell me about my relationship to God? And it will. And the Holy Spirit will take that stuff, even if you don't even know there is a God.
Mm-hmm.
A person with an open heart and mind will be taught by the Holy Spirit
mm-hmm.
out of nature.
Mm-hmm.
I'd like to underline what said a moment ago, Floyd, about I actually think that the dividing line between the moral law and natural law is artificial. It's there.
I agree.
It's there. It's there because it reflects our own viewpoint and understanding. So we see those as different things.
I agree.
And we use different parts of our brains to try to understand them. But at the fundamental level, everything is a demonstration of how God has decided to create and run this universe.
Mm-hmm.
Everything.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, and
on the electron to the atonement theory it's all part of the same thing.
Well, to me in God, natural law and moral law are all one whole.
Right.
He doesn't. We have all these silos.
Yeah. Compartments.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
We segregate everything in different boxes in our head.
And they're all one perfect whole in God.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to go into the science of it, it's like we think about radio waves versus light as very, very different things, but they're not.
No.
Visible light is a very narrow band in all of light, and radio waves are just very long wavelength of light. Uh-huh. And X-rays, which we also think of as very different, they're just a very short
right.
A version of light. But because our eyes are only sensitive to this narrow band, we think of it as different. And, you know, as far as our perception, it is fundamentally different.
By the way, so I have a question. Are radio frequencies light?
Yes. Yes, that's what I'm saying.
Okay.
They're just different wavelengths of light. So blue is very high frequency. Red is very low frequency. Radio waves are orders of magnitude into the red spectrum.
Oh,
X-rays are orders of magnitude into the blue spectrum.
Yes.
So there was a scientist that my mother met when she was 5 years old, when she was with her dad, who discovered that radio frequencies could kill diseases.
Oh, yeah. I have the book.
It is true.
Yeah.
I have used the machine. And it has been successful. And it would make sense that it would be if it's based on light.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Because light destroys
mm-hmm.
what is abnormal and not. Which is why we can't see God's face and live.
Mm-hmm.
Until we're healed.
So you were talking about how close they could get. I don't know that this would be applicable there, but and certainly at the end, the final destruction of sin and sinners, I believe that God has been protecting us mm-hmm. from mm-hmm. that light, mm-hmm. and that mm-hmm. part of a significant part of that is our ability to hide from the truth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We don't have to look at the truth of what we have done in particular. And that at the very end, when God steps back and says, I'm not gonna hold this.
That's right.
And the only people who can survive it are the people who don't block that light. They let it flow through freely. If you block the light, you absorb it. It heats up. And
that's right. That's why resistance is our worst
thing. Resisting the love.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
if you resist the attraction, you're destroyed by it.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Right, it's the resistance to that light that destroys, not the light itself.
That's right. That's okay. Right.
If you let it pass, if you let it pass through,
okay.
It fear, actually energizes you if you don't resist.
And fear is resistance.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
That's why all through Scripture, every time God or His agents show up, the first thing they have to say, it's not like, no. "Oh, let me calm you down. You're afraid." No, they're like, "Don't be afraid," because you have to make a conscious choice not to go that direction, because if you remain afraid, you're going to malfunction
mm-hmm.
and you can't even think straight what they're trying to tell you. And I think the problem with Zachariah was he stayed afraid and he malfunctioned, and it cost him for 9 months or a year. Yeah, that was one of the biggest breakthroughs I had when I began realizing that resistance itself is our greatest danger mm-hmm. and that salvation is not about letting us into heaven or not, like most people think it is. Salvation is preparing our condition to be able to come into that presence without mm-hmm. reacting in fear.
Mm-hmm.
So preparation for Jesus coming is about getting rid of all resistance out of our life, not trying to keep the rules perfectly to impress mm-hmm. him, to give us a ticket into heaven like we've made it out to be. No, it's letting go of our resistance and coming to know him intimately and being willing to be totally vulnerable. And vulnerability means I've let go of all resistance.
Which is why that doesn't happen right away at the end. There's a reason that there's this big, long time span between the second coming and the time God says, okay, this is it.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people, the thief on the cross did not have a chance to overcome his resistance.
Right.
You know? And none of us, there's a question in my mind, at least, that, well, maybe some just before the second coming have gotten there. I don't know. But
I think the vast majority
the vast majority are not going to be at that place. And there'll be a long time of healing before people are ready to face that unfiltered glory of God.
So if we understand the loud cry and the latter rain to be the full unveiling of God's glory as much as we can handle on earth.
Mm-hmm.
That the litmus test of that is those who can see Jesus come.
Yes.
And see that light and that glory.
Right.
Where all the wicked are dying.
Mm-hmm.
of fear.
Of fear. There is a moment, Ellen White says, when the righteous even are a little afraid, they say, who shall be able to stand? And Jesus says, my grace is sufficient for you. And they go, this is our God. This is the one we worship. Yeah.
But she said that there was a long pause.
Yes.
Before he said that. And I believe they were in the cleansing mode, you know, all the way up to this point. And this is the last residue of fear and resistance that he has to stop and let that fear leave. In other words, they have to choose to believe. Yes, it's really true. This is the God we're waiting for, but is he going to confirm that? And that's like the finale of, okay, let that last little bit just leave. Okay, now we're ready. Now, Gene, you had a weekend series a long time ago on this very thing that was an eye-opener for me that really helped.
Face-to-face.
What was God's Face, the God's Face series. And I think there was four parts that you had in that where you said, I don't believe anyone is going to actually see God's face until Judgment Day. And I completely agree with that. Even during the millennium, you know, we'll see Jesus, but God's face will have to be somewhat veiled because we're not ready yet. There has to be this maturing process.
It could be. And I mean, I didn't remember saying that. But
yeah, you'll have to go back and listen to that series.
I should go back and
really
listen
good.
To myself. Huh? Yeah. I hate listening to myself. But
well, you know what? I have listened to some of my own sermons, and sometimes I'm embarrassed because I'm so inspired by them and I don't even remember saying the stuff. I was like, this is really good. I wish I knew this. Well, wait, that's me talking.
But I have a question. You referenced that they could see Jesus' face, but not God's face.
Well, we saw Jesus' face when he was on earth.
During
right?
the millennium.
But Jesus is God.
Jesus
a veiled version of God.
A veiled version.
But when he's in heaven, will there be still a veiled version?
Because he's human.
Because what he's saying, Peggy, is that the thief on the cross, for example, the heathen who knew through the laws of nature God, and the people who grew up afraid of God but still tried to trust him. A real dissonance, but they still tried to trust him. Those people need a millennium to grow up.
Yeah, I get the thing that's puzzling me is it almost sounds like Jesus is less than God.
No, he's simply the veiled version.
Okay.
Not less than, he's protecting us from full exposure.
But we could see him.
Part of this is a fundamental misunderstanding of the deep essence of God. Jesus is the incarnation of God, and the fundamental nature of the deity behind that is incomprehensible to us, and I think will always remain so.
Right.
So when we're talking about seeing the unveiled glory of God, it's still just his glory that we're seeing. It's not, so there is no face of God in the way we think of it. There's just the next layer of revelation about the infinite depth of God. But we can't even take that next step until we have let go of all of resistance to it.
Okay.
Yeah, that Face of God series is on the website.
Yeah, I knew it was. That was at Redwood Camp Meeting, the first time I went there. I've been there three times. And that was to the adult group, and I got in trouble for that.
Well, that's no surprise. Jesus was always getting in trouble, so you're in good company.
But I'll have to say, I've wanted for years to turn that into a book.
Mm.
But I've never had time. Mm. And God keeps putting other books in front of me. No, this one next. So I don't know if I'll ever get to it.
So what picture did you portray that you got in trouble for?
The death of the wicked.
Okay.
The usual one.
Gotcha. All right. You get it.
And I don't know if you're familiar with Elder Wheeland. He is, in his writings and preaching, he is very forensic sounding.
Mm-hmm.
So he was the last person I ever expected to do this. But he found me somewhere on the campground on the last day, I think it was, or the next to the last day. And he said, he came up to me and he said, "Gene, I want you to know that I stood up for you." He said, "I had people coming to me, Elder Wheeland, she's telling us this, this, and this. That's not right, is it?" And I said, "Oh, yes, it is."
Maybe he was just playing it safe using forensic language.
I guess so.
But he knew that you were speaking the truth more plainly.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, I can't camouflage. And maybe it's that I have the Prometheus temperament type. You know, the Greek god Prometheus found fire and got hung up in the sky for birds to eat out his flesh. Because he found fire. And they call the NT, which is more the scientific type temperament. That doesn't mean other temperaments aren't scientists, but it's kind of the type that thinks in terms of logical paradigms, mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. They call it the Promethean temperament.
Mm.
So I tend to go, "Okay, you're going to slaughter me, but I'm going to tell the truth anyway."
Do you think that there are a number of them out there that wish they had the courage to do what you do?
I don't know. There's few that do have that courage.
Mm-hmm.
I know of some.
There's no doubt been consequences for it, right?
They've seen consequences, I think, in other people and go, "Oh, mm-hmm. I better be mm-hmm. careful."
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think it's similar to Jesus' day, where many of the priests were convicted of the truth, mm-hmm. but they were afraid until after the resurrection. And finally, they're like, "We can't play this game anymore.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have to come out in the open."
Mm-hmm. Well, that's how Ellen White describes the latter rain.
Mm.
When the latter rain is poured out, and of course, with the priests, they were responding to the early rain.
Right.
When the latter rain is poured out, that people are unbound, children who have been held back by their parents. And she doesn't say people who are held back by other church members, but that I'm sure that's in it.
She does mm-hmm. say that our greatest opposition will be other church members.
Mm-hmm.
The thing we have the greatest fear is of the church.
Yeah.
Is within us. Yeah.
There's an interesting observation. I don't know if any of you have read The Road Less Traveled in his follow-on book, mm-hmm. The People of the Lie, on the psychology of evil. If mm-hmm. you want to find truly evil people, don't go look in the Hell's Angels or for the warlords. You go look at the elders in your church,
mm-hmm.
because evil always, always cloaks itself in good.
Mm-hmm. I believe it. In fact, evil proclaims that it's good.
Mm.
Like the boss I had, Mark, you know her, at Loma Linda. And
yes, they do.
I found a mistake that she had made on a form she gave me to use. And I walked into her office and I said, mentioning her name, I see there's a mistake on this form. And she bellowed, "Trust me, don't do this to me, trust me." And I thought, how dare she say, trust me, when she's not trustworthy?
Yeah.
She's a good illustration of the general principle that such people are always driven by insecurity and fear. I know for a fact she was.
And before I left her office, I mean, before I left that department, I won't tell what school it is because this is recorded. I had a talk with her about her picture of God. And it was exactly like she. Exactly.
It was exactly.
And I wasn't surprised at all. I expected that. I'm sorry, what?
You said her picture of God was exactly what?
Like her.
I missed the word. Like her. Okay, got it. Yeah.
But that's a principle.
It is.
By beholding, you become changed.
Mm-hmm. And you know, we human beings, by creation design, have to reflect the image of God.
Mm-hmm.
That's the definition of a human. So we don't have a choice. The question is, what version of God are you going to reflect? Because whatever you believe, that's what you're going to act like, because you have to reflect it. That's why the only resolution for sin is to correct our picture of God.
Mm-hmm.
Not to stop doing evil, but to look at a better reflection or a better original, so that's what we reflect.
To stop doing evil with a wrong picture of God is to become a rebel.
Yes, mm-hmm. Right.
It goes back to having the correct picture of God.
And that has to continue to improve.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I'm going to go off the deep end a little bit here, but since God is the author of all reality, to know what God is like is to be in tune with reality as it truly is.
Yes.
To not understand what God is like is to be out of tune with the reality in which you live.
That is what I mean by coming out of Babylon. Right there.
And I believe that the principles that God has designed creation or to govern all of creation, and all of them are principles. I don't think God has any artificial laws necessarily. He might, but they're very temporary and dated, I think. But all of the principles, by the very nature of principles, is that they have power within the principle. And that power that is encapsulated or invested into the principle, which synchronizes with all the other principles, and they perfectly harmonize with each other. When we interact with those principles, when we violate them, a curse is released. When we are in harmony with them, a blessing is released. And then we say that God's doing that. And that's okay, because he created the principles. He'll take the credit for the blessings and the curses. You know, you can stamp his name on it. But the fact is, these are principles that operate, and you can't break principles. I mean, you can violate them, but you're not going to stop the principles from happening.
That's why in the Bible, and I haven't checked this out to see if this is true of ancient Mesopotamia, but in the Bible, the most common curse was, you are cursed. It's not, I curse you, but you are cursed.
The revelation of what already is.
Yeah. But what is interesting is I've been able to demonstrate, not as easily as some of the other ones, but I've been able to demonstrate that God's preferred will was not to curse people, not to pronounce a curse on them. Well, and the first curse pronounced on a person is by Noah. In the Bible.
It's what we're describing here, though, of the is the definition of natural consequences.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Working out of the laws of reality as God created them to be.
Exactly. Exactly.
It requires no intervention or changing right. anything other than just
that's how God does.
This is what this is the way it works. Intervene. What was that?
I said that's the way God does the cursing. He doesn't intervene.
Yeah.
It describes right. what's going to happen. But the principle itself releases the curse because you have refused to be brought back into alignment with the principle. The sermon we heard just this morning, the whole sermon was about curses. It was really good. And he talked about, you know, the generational curses, and he used the illustration of Noah down four generations. He used the illustration of Herod and his son, four generations. And all these examples of a curse being passed down generationally until somebody breaks it. But it goes to the third and fourth generation.
If you go to the Ten Commandments, the second commandment, visiting the iniquity of the fathers upon the children and to the third and fourth generation of those that hate me and keeping mercy for thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments. It seems I've taken that to mean that word visiting has been translated in many modern versions as punishing.
Right.
But if you go to the Akkadian, which has the same word, it has no meaning of punishment in Akkadian. It means to oversee, to take charge, to I can't remember all the meanings. One of my classmates who was actually in the same program I was for my doctorate, we came in the same year. So we kind of went to classes together and talked a lot. But she said to me, that's one of those words where it means just about anything. But I've taken it to mean that he administers, he takes charge, because if he doesn't mitigate the consequences, they will be unending. Mm-hmm. What this text is saying is that, yes, he set in motion a law that what you do in one generation is going to have an effect on another generation. In fact, genetically, that effect is from, it skips generations, it's grandfather to grandson to on and on. So that you're biologically more like your grandparents than you are your parents.
Mm.
But anyway, it does go, but it also goes generation to generation. So an alcoholic can produce an alcoholic child, or a child with the alcoholic gene, and a pedophile, their offspring can be pedophiles. And so a pedophile is usually created by pedophilia. Anyway, so you go.
I was gonna say that the third and fourth generation, the problem with that is that it renews in the next generation. So an alcoholic that comes along and has an alcoholic child, if he doesn't break the cycle, then right. it's the third and fourth generation after him.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And it just keeps going until somebody says, I'm not going to do this.
But let me tell you what a counselor said. Actually, there was a study done of pedophilia. And they discovered that it was at the third or fourth generation that a child would break the cycle. I told a counselor that, and she said that was true in her experience with working with people. That's usually at the third or fourth generation that the cycle is broken. And I watched that in my own family. Mm-hmm. My great-grandfather was abusive. My grandfather told me that he and his three brothers, he had more brothers later on, but at this time he had three brothers. They were all young. When they saw their father coming home, he always walked home from town where he was a banker, but he had a farm. When he'd come down across the farm toward the house, they would run under the house and hide because their only identification with him was a beating. And my grandfather would beat his fostered sons. One of them he beat so badly and so long that my grandmother went out yelling, "I'll call the police if you don't stop." And he horsewhipped my mother when she was five until she passed out. So this was a very abusive man. My mother broke that cycle. She refused to abuse her children. That didn't mean everything was perfect about her, but she eventually read child guidance and discovered that Ellen White wasn't great on whipping, spanking. So she stopped spanking and she used reason. She would sit us down and talk to us. And she had much better cooperation doing that.
Mm-hmm.
So I've watched this in my own family, and I really think that God set a kind of some kind of default that gives each third and fourth generation the choice. It doesn't mean they'll take it, but that gives them the choice of not doing that.
Expiration date.
And consequently, I see that as a promise.
Yeah.
Rather than a command or a punishment. And anybody at any level, at any generation, can make that choice because we're free.
Mm-hmm.
So keeping mercy to thousands of those who love me and keep my commandments.
That actually means thousands of generations.
Yeah.
And I figured out there hasn't been a thousand generations since the creation yet.
Well, this is the only picture of God that has enabled me to love him.
Mm.
Yeah.
And that was the turning point in my life when I realized I didn't love God.
Mm.
The Holy Spirit started working on me by reminding me of a week of prayer speaker who said, all we have to do is love God. Because if we love him, we will keep his commandments and so on. And that kept ringing in my ears. And I realized I didn't love God.
Mm.
And it didn't matter whether love was a principle or a feeling. I didn't have either one. So I went to him and I began to plead with him to please help me to love him. And I knew about Morris Vanden because I'd read one of his sermons, and he was big on you've got to know him in order to love him. And so he suggested reading Desire of Ages 30 minutes a day. And so I thought, oh, that's something I can do. So I pulled out my clock and I sat down and I started reading Desire of Ages, and I'd look at the clock and I'd read Desire of Ages and I'd look at the clocks, and the time seemed to drag by and I wasn't getting anywhere about love. I wasn't loving God anymore from reading Desire of Ages. I began to get angry with God because he wasn't answering my prayer.
Mm.
Didn't he want me to love him? And then one night I met him. And at the cross, I realized a God who would go so far to win me back was a God I could trust. And that was why I couldn't love him. I couldn't trust him. So that to me is the heart of the Ten Commandments.
Mm-hmm.
And God simply had to package them in legal language so that we could somehow get the point, at least part of the point,
mm-hmm.
about what mm-hmm. love is.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I think our time is probably up. This has been a great discussion.
Yes, yes, it has.
I want to thank everyone for sharing from their heart. And I apologize about next week, but we will be on the next week.
Okay.
And lo and behold, we're ready to go to chapter 6. That's the downside of Revelation.
Mm. <You know?
laughs> That's where it starts going downhill big time.
Yeah. Mm. To the point of the lamb's wrath. Mm. Have you ever seen a lamb get angry? Well, it is possible. I read a story of a girl who raised sheep, her family actually sheep raisers, and she had, I think it was a female lamb or female sheep, but from lambhood, it would just butt people and be antagonistic and not come into line. And it was amazing. I thought, I didn't know sheep could do that. So maybe, unfortunately, through the centuries, they've learned from us how to behave.
Yeah.
All right, let's have prayer. Gracious Father, when we realize the risks that you have taken to make yourself known, the risks that you have taken to allow us to be free, to allow the universe to be free, the risks of our misunderstanding you, we thank you for your patience. We thank you for the freedom you have given us, because without that, there would be nothing genuine. We ask that you will continue to grow us and help us to see you more clearly. In Jesus' name, amen. Mm-hmm.